All right. Greetings, everyone, and thank you once again for stopping by another episode of Live with the Infidel Guy. Actually, this is more than just another episode. We are going to this is going to be a very interesting debate. We have two articulate individuals that's going to be appearing on the show. You know Massimo Pigliucci. He's been on the show before. And we also have Kent Hovind of DrDino.com. Now, we're going to be discussing three different topics this evening. We're going to be discussing, how do we decide what to teach in science public school classrooms? Is creationism a scientific alternative to evolution? And also, what is science? Now, Massimo Pigliucci, as you know, he teaches at the University at Knoxville, Tennessee, and he is an associate professor in biology and also ecology and botany as well. And Kent Hovind is, once again, he is a creationist. He comes from the creationist side of things. And he is, you can check him out at DrDino.com. You can find out more about him there. Well, also, first of all, I'd like to say welcome to the debate and, well, to the show, gentlemen.
Hello, it's a pleasure being here.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good to be with you.
Okay, great. Well, first, I guess we'll start off with, Mr. Kent Hovind, can you tell us more about yourself, please?
Yes, sir. I taught high school science and math for 15 years and moved to Pensacola, Florida 13 years ago. I started writing letters to the editor about the evolution propaganda in the textbooks and in the news media, and ended up growing into a full-time ministry. I now speak about 700 or 800 times a year all over the world on creation, evolution, and dinosaurs and related topics. I've done quite a few debates at universities against professors who believe in evolution, including two against Dr. Pigliucci, and we'll be glad to face them again anytime. We want to debate the university someplace or tonight here, but yeah, I defend the Bible view as being the Bible is literally true, scientifically accurate. The Earth is not billions of years old. The evolution theory that's taught in our schools is the dumbest idea in the history of humanity, and it is bolstered up by nothing but lies that have been proven wrong over many years.
Okay. And Dr. Massimo Pigliucci, tell us and the listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Well, I'm not a professional anti-creationist. It's only for as a hobby, or actually more precisely, because I think somebody's got to do it. I have debated, in fact, Mr. Hovind twice in live, and I think one more time on radio. So this is the second radio debate, although this is the first time on the internet. And I teach evolutionary biology and ecology at the University of Tennessee. If people are more interested in what I do and what I write, they can go to my website at www.rationallyspeaking.org. I think we should cut down with the introductions and get to the point.
Okay. Well, we have three topics here. And by the way, I've also forgot to mention to the people listening right now very quickly here, is that toward the end of the show, about maybe 5 minutes toward to the top of the hour, we're going to have a listener call-in session in which you can call in and ask Mr. Kent Hovind here or Dr. Massimo Pigliucci your questions. And we're also giving away a free subscription to Live with the Infidel Guy, unlimited access to anyone who poses the best question, whether it be a Christian or both. Well, I guess I shouldn't say a Christian, but a theist or a non-theist. But we prefer that you're in the chat room, so that way the individuals can vote for you. You'll see the guys vote for you there in the chat room. So come on by, and toward the end of the show, go ahead and call in and start sending your questions. By the way, Brian, please go ahead and post a number there in the chat room, but I will say it here as well, 404-696-2864 to call in and to get live on the air. All right, well, I guess I'll start with Mr. Kent Hovind here. How exactly do we decide what to teach in science public school classrooms?
Well, the word science means knowledge. More expanded definition is knowledge gained by observation, by experimentation, things that we can observe and study and test. I think the whole subject of origins is technically outside the field of science. So whether it be creation or evolution, I suppose neither one can be proven scientifically. What you'd have to do then is look at the scientific evidence and see what conclusions it leads to.
Okay.
And in science public school classrooms, since they're taxpayer funded, number one, we should only teach true things that have been proven, you know, that certainly not things that have been proven wrong. And there are many things in the textbooks that have been proven wrong years ago, but they keep them in there because that's the only way they can, you know, hold up this evolution theory is by things that have been proven wrong for centuries or for decades in many cases. So in science, in public schools, we should teach science, and we probably should totally avoid the subject of origins, be it creation or evolution. A bigger question is, should we even have public schools? I think according to our Constitution, the Tenth Amendment, it would certainly prohibit federal intervention in public schools. It's actually children are a gift from God to parents, and they're entrusted to parents, not to the state. So I would vote for closing the public schools down, but if we're going to have them, then we should avoid the subject of origins.
Uh-huh. Okay, Dr. Maslow Pigliucci?
Well, this is a series of interesting statements. I think I will gloss over, if you don't mind, unless Kent really wants to debate that on the question of should we have public schools, because that seems to be a little bit outside of the topic tonight, and we only have an hour to address three important topics. I'll be more than glad if he insists to debate that point as well, but that really doesn't have much to do with the question of evolution.
Okay.
So let's go to the other two points that he's made. First of all, that he says science is about means knowledge originally, which is true, although the meaning of science, the term science, has changed dramatically over the last few hundred years. And he says it's based on observation and experimentation and things you can test. That is all true. Now, he then concludes that what he refers to as origins research, therefore, is not science. Presumably, though, he didn't say that because one cannot experiment or observe it or something like that, or test hypotheses about it. Well, that's surprising from a scientific perspective because the field of origins, which, by the way, is not a field identified as such by any scientist that I know of.
Okay.
Creationists have this tendency to mix up a bunch of different things into one under one term, origin. In reality, we're talking about at least three different origins here. We're talking about the origins of the universe. We're talking about the origin of life on Earth, and probably we're talking about the origin of humans. Those three are actually three very different fields of research, which actually belong to three different sciences altogether. The first one goes under the rubric of cosmology, the second one under biophysics and biochemistry, and the third one under evolution and paleontology. So there are three different things. But nevertheless, all three of them are sciences in the sense that one can, in fact, make observations and can, in fact, test hypotheses. One cannot necessarily do experiments, although experiments on the origin of life can be done. It's very difficult, I agree, to experiment on the origin of the universe, at least up to this point. But science, contrary to what Ovin said, it's not only about experiments. It's about testing hypotheses. One can test hypotheses of historical events. The second point was that schools are taxpayer-funded, therefore taxpayers should essentially get to decide what is taught in schools. Well, that piece of reasoning is so ludicrous that if we applied it to any other publicly funded agency or activity, one would have a situation in which, say, for example, since hospitals, some hospitals can be publicly funded, then the public should decide what kind of operation procedures a surgeon should put into practice in a particular case. That's obviously not the case. What public funding means is that the public is paying experts, in that case, in an hospital, for example, medical doctors, to make the right decisions. And, you know, if those doctors don't make the right decisions, if they become incompetent, then they can be fired. But it's not just because somebody pays for something, that doesn't mean that that person is in a position to actually give detailed directions on how to implement that thing. The same goes with public schools. We pay some people that are trained in order to teach certain subjects, and those people should be the ones that decide what needs to be taught and what not, because those are the ones that got the appropriate training, just in the case of medical doctors.
Okay. Mr. Ken Hovind, want to respond?
Oh, yeah, that's ridiculous. If a hospital decided, they're publicly funded, they decided they want to do surgeries like Hitler did, you know, where you're going to do these bizarre things where you know, try to sew an arm into somebody's back or something, of course the public would have a right to object to that. And if the public schools are teaching something that the public, that the people who are paying the bills object to, then they certainly have a right. What Mr. Pigliucci wants is, I know you're calling him doctor and me mister, so I guess you should make a level playing field here. I have a doctor's degree also, though it's not from an accredited university, but I don't think that matters. The public certainly has an opportunity to decide where their funding goes. If they object, then they should you know, if you want to do privately funded schools, and, you know, the Christians have private schools all over America, all over the world, I think the evolutionists should start private schools, and anybody that wants to pay and come learn it can certainly come learn it. This is America. You can do whatever you want, but you can't, you know, when you're dealing with public funding, you can't promote one religion, which is all evolution is a religion. You have to believe all sorts of things to believe in evolution. Then you're using tax funding dollars to support a religion, and that's unconstitutional and not right.
Right.
Okay, 2 points. Then one back to my example of doctors. Of course, if doctors in hospitals were all of a sudden deciding to do what we would consider unethical operations, then we would stop them, not only because we pay them, but simply because they would be criminal, been doing criminal activities. Now, that is certainly not the case in, for a teacher who teaches evolution. As far as I know, not only it is not a crime to teach evolution, but as a matter of fact, court decisions over and over have established that teaching evolution is perfectly legal. In fact, it's the teaching of creationism that is not legal simply because creationism really is religion and shouldn't be taught in public schools according to our constitution. So, it seems to me that my analogy with the surgeons still holds. The people that decide if the surgeon is incompetent or not are other surgeons, because those are the people that are trained to do that sort of job. In the same way, people that decide what a teacher should teach and if a teacher is incompetent are other teachers or people that are trained in that discipline, not somebody who doesn't know anything about it. It seems simply a matter of very basic logic to me. As far as the statement that evolution is a religion, this is something that some creationists, not all of them, there is quite a bit of disagreement on this particular issue among even creationists themselves, but some creationists, and I gather Ken Owen is one of them, insist that evolution is a religion. I would really like to know from Ken what exactly does he mean by that, because the statement sounds ridiculous to me on the face of it, but I'd like to know what exactly he means by religion, and why would evolution qualify as a religion?
Well, a religion is a belief in a power or powers that created the universe, is the typical dictionary definition. You can look it up in just about any dictionary. It'll give you that something along that line. The evolution theory is, it's not even a theory, it's a hypothesis or religion. The evolutionists believe, and I'll put a capital B on that, that the universe came into existence without a designer. They believe that life got started without a designer or a creator, or whatever you want to call God. They believe that life forms change into different types of life forms over time. None of that's been observed. Dogs produce dogs. Now, if you want to believe that a dog came from a rock 4.6 billion years ago, which is precisely what evolution teaches, if you boil away all the fluff and the feathers, then you're welcome to believe that. But you're taking that totally on faith. You have never seen, and nobody has ever seen, life come from non-living material. You have never seen any planet or star or universe create itself from nothing. You have never seen any animal produce a different kind of animal. You take all these things on faith. You believe them. So yes, it's very much a religion, and you're welcome to your religion. But you're not welcome to use my tax dollars to teach it to all the rest of the kids. That's all.
Well, the bit about the tax dollars, you should complain directly to the Supreme Court, because they decided that, in fact, your tax dollars are perfectly validly used in order to teach science, and in particular to teach evolution. And the reason they found that is because these arguments that evolution is a religion has in fact been advanced in court, and the court has resoundingly refuted their argument, rejected that argument. Let's start with your definition of what a religion is. First of all, a religion may or may not include the belief in a creator of the universe. A religion more generally is the belief in some kind of supernatural entity out there doing something. That something may or may not have something to do with the creation of the universe. There are religions that don't have, for example, creation stories, and yet they still qualify as religions. But one of the elements that is fundamental in the definition of religion is the belief in some kind of supernatural entity or power. Now, evolutionary biologists, as far as I know, when their job is evolutionary biologists, don't call they don't invoke any supernatural power in order to explain the diversity of life on Earth. So just by that definition, simply, evolution is not a religion. The other thing to keep in mind is that you keep talking about belief. Now, belief is an interesting term, because it can be used in a variety of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
If by belief you mean blind faith with no reason whatsoever, then no, evolutionary biologists don't believe in evolution by blind faith. they have information, they have observation, they have tested certain parts of their theory, and so on. So they have a belief in the sense that any scientist would have a reasonable belief, meaning a probabilistic statement, that something is or is not true. Science, contrary to religion, is not about absolute truth. It's the best we can do in science is to reach a reasonable belief or a reasonable conclusion about something. That is what evolution is about. But if you use the word belief in that sense, you're obviously very far from what is meant in by that term, by that word in within a religious context. The other thing to keep in mind, which I think is incredibly annoying that the creationists keep confusing these things, is that actually evolutionary biology has absolutely nothing to do with origins. Evolutionary theory does not say anything about the origin of the universe, and evolutionary theory does not say anything about the origin of life. Evolution, by definition, started out, biological evolution, started out after the origin of life. If you actually read either Darwin or anything, any other evolutionary biologist after Darwin in the last 140 years, there is not a single thing in technical publications on evolution that deals with either the origin of the universe or the origin of life, not because those are not important or they're not scientific or whatever else, but that's because, as I said a few minutes ago, those are actually outside of the purview of evolutionary theory. They are dealt with by other branches of science. So, from that perspective, evolution doesn't have anything to do even with the question of origin to begin with.
Well, you would have to, anybody would obviously have to agree that before you can get life to evolve, you have to get a universe here for it to exist in, and you have to get life to get started. So those are two major things that are taken as assumptions. So there again, you go back to a religion. You believe that they happened, and then your starting point is after that. I guess you probably need to define for the audience exactly what you mean by the word evolution. And I can assure you, I have the public school textbooks here in front of me by the hundreds. What is taught in the textbooks and what is taught at your university, and I'm sure what is taught in your class, is much more than just the origin of different varieties of animals. It does include the origin of the universe and the origin of life. That's what's in the textbooks. Send me the book you use to teach from, and I'll show it to you.
I can do that. I can give you the references. Now, in the books that I teach from at the college level, there is absolutely nothing about either the origin of life or the origin of the universe. And again, that's not because those are not important or scientific fields of inquiry. It's just because they are not evolutionary biology. And so since I teach evolutionary biology and not either biology in general or science in general, then those topics are not there. Now, you ask me, how do I define evolution? The technical definition of evolution can be given along one of two different lines which turn out to be equivalent. One is what you find in most textbooks today. Evolution is simply a change over time in gene frequencies. So if the genes that make up a population change over time in response due to whatever phenomenon, some of those changes can be due to natural selection, but not all of them, that is defined as evolution occurring, pure and simple. What those changes in gene frequencies actually imply for the organism, that is, of course, an interesting question, and that's what evolutionary biologists are interested in finding out and studying. But the definition of evolution is simply, and rather innocuously, I would think, a change in of gene frequencies over time. Another definition of evolution, an older one, which is the one that essentially Darwin applied and used in his book, in his writings, is simply that evolution is descent with modification. By descent with modification, he meant the idea that living organisms are related to each other as by lineage, so they all belong to a certain family tree, if you like. They're all cousins and second cousins and third cousins of each other. And over time, these relationships have, of course, diverged and changed so that different organisms look different, essentially. Just in the same way in which, of course, on a much, much more smaller scale, people look different from each other. We're all human beings, but we all also look different, and the reason we look different is exactly the same, that is, there are changes in the genetic constitution of each organism and in the way in which these organisms react to their environment, which make us different. So these are the two definitions of evolution, which really strike me as rather innocuous and with very little metaphysical implication. But I'm sure that you're going to disagree with that.
Oh, no. If that's really how you define evolution, then I think the creationists would certainly agree. The gene frequencies change, but they change around a central norm, and there are definite limits to the change. All we've observed is the dogs change to get big dogs or little dogs, but they don't change into cows or bananas or pine trees. The changes are limited. So if you want to believe that the gene frequency changes that we observe can lead to something greater than has ever been observed in human history, you can believe that, but that's where you just leave science and go to your religion. I agree. Modification happens due to numerous factors. Natural selection happens. Environmental pressures cause organisms to survive that are of a certain type and cause others to die that are of a certain type. But it doesn't make a new, different kind of animal out of it or a new, different kind of plant. I would agree the dog, the wolf, and the coyote, the gene frequency has changed over time, and they are now very different. But they're recognizably the same kind of animal. But that does not prove that the dog and the pine tree have a common ancestor, which is exactly what you believe.
Yeah, I do have this belief, if by belief you mean, as I said above, an opinion based on information, on the available information, that living organisms do share a common ancestry. I don't believe, contrary to what you keep repeating, that dogs come from bananas or things of that sort. What evolutionary theory says is not that. What it says is that living organisms have common ancestors, which means that, yes, eventually banana trees, by the way, not bananas as fruits, but banana trees, bananas as plants, as a species, eventually, if you go far back enough in time, and we're talking now more than 500 million years, then they do have a common ancestor with the lineage that eventually gave origin to animals and therefore mammals and therefore dogs. But that common ancestor looked nothing like either a banana or a dog for obvious reasons. And in fact, it was essentially a small multicellular organism that that probably lived in the water and was making his living in a very different way from both banana trees and dogs. Now, why do I believe that? Well, yes, you're right that nobody has actually observed that. But there are plenty of things in science that we don't observe, and yet scientists have, I think, good reasons to believe they're true. For example, nobody has ever observed an atom, and nevertheless, there is plenty of indirect scientific evidence that atoms exist, or even, in fact, subatomic particles. By the same token, we've never seen, for example, a star directly forming. And yet we think we have a pretty good idea of how that happens simply because we've seen a bunch of the intermediate stages. We can look at telescopes at a bunch of the intermediate stages that fit pretty well with, for example, what astronomical theory and physical theory predict. The same goes with biology. Biology is no different from that perspective from any other science. It has an historical component and an experimental component. One of the reasons, for example, we do think that bananas and dogs, for example, used to have hundreds of millions of years ago a common ancestor is because their DNA is, in fact, very similar. It is, of course, the DNA of dogs is much more similar to the DNA of other dogs, and the DNA of dogs is much more similar to the DNA of, say, coyotes or wolves than it is to the DNA of bananas. And yet, there are so many similarities that they just cannot be explained by chance alone. That is one of the most powerful pieces of indirect evidence in favor of the theory of evolution. And by the way, since this was discovered literally several decades, in fact, almost more than a half a century after Darwin's original insight, this is also a pretty good example of a testable theory in evolutionary biology. Darwin did suggest that certain organs should be related in a certain way, and he suggested that on the basis of morphological differences, well, those predictions have turned out to be very consistent with the molecular evidence which came out decades and decades afterwards. That's exactly how science works. There's nothing magical about it, and certainly there's nothing religious about it.
Well, I'm glad you finally admitted that you do think a dog and a banana have a common ancestor, 500 million years ago.
Of course.
Look like either one. Now, this is what you take by faith, though. You believe, and your God, you said earlier, a religion involves a supernatural power. The supernatural power that you follow, with maybe not even realizing it, is time and blind random chance. You keep referring to over time or billions of years ago or whatever. You're welcome to believe that, too. But again, then you just step outside of science and step into religion. You mentioned that the DNA is similar. I would agree. I think if you would go to your library, you would, or any library in America, you would find all of the books written in English. I follow the same basic code. They all use the same 26 letters of the alphabet. Okay, that would be a very interesting scientific observation. As you look through books, you would say, wow, they're all using the same code. Okay, now, what does that prove? Does that prove they all evolve from each other, or does that prove that's the code with which you write English? And I think that's where you're misunderstanding and misleading people. You're looking at the similar DNA structure of different creatures and assuming that it means a common ancestor when it could just as easily mean a common designer.
Mm-hmm.
But you totally ignore the, to me, it's just the obvious.
Right.
This is a common designer that wrote the code.
Right. Well, of course it could be.
Well, why would you say that? You never say that in your class.
Oh, sure. My class is not a class about religion. So if you're invoking, if somebody invokes within a scientific, within a scientific field or a scientific question, when examining a scientific question, if somebody invokes a supernatural entity, then that person is not doing science anymore. By definition, is doing religion, and therefore that's why I don't bring that in my classes. But of course, you're right in a trivial sense. I mean, obviously, anything could be explained with the intervention of a supernatural being. I mean, there is absolutely nothing that could, by definition, since a supernatural being can do whatever the heck he pleases, there is absolutely nothing, there's no observation that could possibly not be explained referring to a supernatural existence or the action of a supernatural being. The question is, why would you want to believe that, since you have a much more simple explanation that doesn't require a supernatural being? I mean, that's the real crux of the matter here. It is not the fact that somebody has a proof that there is no such thing as a supernatural being. That proof cannot be obtained. Plenty of philosophers and scientists actually don't try that sort of stuff. But plenty of philosophers have tried for thousands of years both to prove and to disprove the existence of God. We know that it cannot be done simply because it can't be done logically, and it cannot obviously be done empirically because, again, any observation is compatible with the existence of a supernatural being. So by saying that, well, couldn't it be that was designed? Well, of course it could be, but that doesn't prove anything. Just because something could be proves absolutely nothing. Now, let me go back to your statement that I found very curious, that time, as you said, is a supernatural power. That sounds very odd to me. Time is something that we understand fairly well. It's got nothing supernatural as far as I can tell. And time is the way in which a lot of things happen. Continents move by accumulation of small movements over a long period of time. Now, if we were talking about continental drift instead of evolution, you know, you would be asking me how silly you really think that South America and Africa were once joined in the same continent. That's silly. Look at them today. You cannot observe that happening. You cannot possibly. Nobody was obviously there. It's a completely crazy idea. Well, it may be a completely crazy idea that nobody can observe directly, but in fact we have very good indirect evidence, and we think that is exactly what happened, and it happened by small incremental movements over long periods of time. The same exact way in which bananas and dogs come from a common ancestor, by small changes over a very long period of time. There doesn't seem to be anything incredible in that. What is incredible, of course, what would be incredible is if evolutionary biologists claim that you can do this in, you know, a matter of years or decades. That would be incredible. That would be like a geologist claiming that continental drift actually happens over the lifetime of a human being. But nobody's claiming that, and so to be surprised that over the last 100 years, 150 years, nobody has observed that kind of large, of big evolutionary change, it's really plain disingenuous, because nobody's claiming that evolutionary changes go that fast.
Well,
now, let me, one more thing about, because the thing about language, please be sure that you address this stuff on the time, because it's really bugging me. But the language thing, it's very interesting that you use language as an example, because languages do in fact evolve. They evolve over a small mm-hmm. period of time. And as a matter of fact, the methods that we use in linguistics to study the evolution of languages are very, very similar to the methods that we use in evolutionary biology to study the evolution of living organisms. Essentially the same theory, except for the fact, of course, that there is no natural selection there. Mm-hmm. It's the evolution of language is driven by cultural processes, not by natural selection. But otherwise, the processes are so similar and the dynamics are so similar that, in fact, there is a very interesting collaboration that has been going on for now decades between evolutionary biologists and linguists. Languages do change. And with the way we know that certain languages are connected to each other, which means they derive from each other, is exactly by looking very carefully at the differences and the similarities among these languages. Pretty much the same thing that evolutionary biologists do with living organisms.
All right. Mr. Kittenhoven, I'm going to let you go ahead and finish respond to Massimo, then we're going to move on to the next topic.
Okay. he said his class is not a class about religion. He doesn't bring religion into his class. I can assure you, if he teaches evolution, and I know that he does bring religion into his class and doesn't even realize it or will not admit it. He's welcome to believe that a dog and a banana have a common ancestor, and he admitted that he does believe that. I don't care what he believes. But that's not science. It's true that we can see changes within the dog, but anybody that breeds dogs will tell you there are limits. You reach a certain point and you just can't, there's a brick wall, you can't go any farther. That happened with raising sugar beets. Years ago, the native wild sugar beet was something like 6% sugar or whatever the number is. They through selective breeding, were able to raise it to about 11%, and then they hit a brick wall. They couldn't go any farther. And that's, you know, and anybody that raises anything will tell you, sure, you can get changes, but the changes are limited. Second problem he has in his logic, he thinks South America and Africa used to fit. I think you need to check that very carefully. You find out they shrank Africa about 35 or 40% to make them fit. There's no proof they used to fit. The shapes of these continents is a pure coincidence based upon the water level. I don't dispute that the continents are moving. I think that they are, but that doesn't prove they've been moving for millions of years. It doesn't prove anything. It certainly doesn't prove they used to be joined together. That whole Pangaea theory is certainly a far cry from a scientific fact. You mentioned you have a simple explanation for the universe that does not involve a creator. I would sure love to see what that is, and I'd like to see some scientific evidence, not just the hypothetical could be, might have been, you know, something I believe, a pie in the sky stuff. Last, he brought a bunch of topics here. I'm trying to cover them all. As far as time, that is indeed the magic ingredient, the God, that solves all your problems. If I say, how on earth do you think a dog and a wolf, or a dog and a pine tree, or a banana, could have a common ancestor, you will say, well, we don't see this in our human lifetime, but over billions of years, it happened. There you are, and you still don't see it. Yes, that is your God. Time solves your problem. You mentioned languages evolve, then you don't understand what the word evolution means, because languages are changing because of intelligent input. Evolution wants to deny any intelligent input. So this is a vast difference. Computers are nothing but natural components, but that doesn't mean they form themselves. And yes, life is made of, you know, 92 basic elements, but that doesn't prove it designed itself. How you can miss that, I don't know, unless it's, you know, what the Bible says, that, you know, they're blinded because they don't want to believe there's a creator for some other reason. And I don't know about that in your case, but I would start looking there if I was to analyze this. To me, it's obvious, certainly to most Americans, it's obvious there must have been a designer. And if you don't want to believe in it, that's your business. But if you want to use tax dollars to teach other kids that there is no designer, ooh, now that's my business.
Okay. Well, now I guess I'm curious now. I was going to save this to the end, but now I'm curious. Mr. Hoven, how is it that you know that the universe has a designer? What evidence do you have that the universe is designed?
If I was walking through the woods and found a painting hanging on a tree, and I looked around and found no footprints, no evidence of anybody being around, I would still assume there was a painter. Whether I ever find out who did it or not is unimportant. The fact is, a painting demands a painter. If you're walking through the woods and you find a building, and you find no evidence of any human being around except this building, even a simple building, a little lean-to shed, it requires an intelligent designer. Somebody mm-hmm. designed it. And when you look at the creation, you look at the world through a microscope or the universe through a telescope, it's shouting at us, there must have been a designer. There's design everywhere we look. You'd have to be willingly ignorant, like it says in 2 Peter, to not believe there was a designer for this marvelous universe. And just take one single cell. Any living cell is more complex than a space shuttle, which required thousands of extremely intelligent engineers to design, and it is absolutely crude by comparison to one single living cell. So if you want to choose to believe there's no designer, that's certainly your business. I can't prove it to you, mm-hmm. but any more than I could, if we're walking through the woods and we found a painting and you said, I don't see any footprints, so I don't believe anybody did it, Well, okay. I can't help you then.
That's interesting. But of course, we already have prior knowledge that we know that these objects are man-made because we made them ourselves. Don't you think that analogy is rather vacuous? Because maybe if you said maybe something we did not create and you think you see design in that, I can understand. But you utilize a painting. We know in buildings. We make these things.
Okay,
so of course, we know their design because we designed them.
Okay, suppose you're walking through the woods and you find something totally foreign, like you would see on Star Trek, okay? Something that nobody's ever made, something, you know, totally wild beyond your imagination. But yet artifacts still show evidence of intelligent design. Whether you've ever seen, I don't know, painting, you know, okay, pick something else then that you can find on Star Trek. Okay, it still proves a designer.
But you mentioned Star Trek, but our imaginations are limited based on knowledge that we already have about things. That's why in Star Trek, a lot of these things look like design. They look similar to things that we know of already because, once again, we're basing them off of, it's a mental pattern. We're basing them off of things that we know of already, right? I mean, that's why...
This is very interesting because the discussion you guys are having is exactly, I mean, almost to the word, the discussion that went on about 150 years, almost 200 years ago, between David Hume, who was playing a Reginald part in that, and of course, now the name escaped me, but the first person who actually proposed the idea of intelligent design, pretty much in the form in which Ken Homan is referring to it, the idea of the watchmaker, you know, the watch that is made by a watchmaker, and so on and so forth.
Oh, Haley.
Thank you.
Haley.
And the arguments that they used are pretty much the ones that you're using today. And philosophically speaking, most philosophers would agree, in fact, do agree today, that Hume definitely carried the day, except for one thing. Hume's argument was exactly what Reginald was saying, that is that the problem with the design argument is that we don't actually, the analogy is actually pretty weak, because while a watch is clearly indisputably an artifact, the only reason we know that is clearly indisputably an artifact is because we know people that make watches and how watches are made. And we know that, as far as we can tell, there's no natural phenomenon that can produce a watch. That's what makes the watch or the painting example so compelling. The problem when the same analogy, the same argument is applied to living organisms is that it massively begs the question in philosophical terms, because you cannot assume that the living organism is designed or is an example of design, because that's exactly the question you're trying to answer. So if you start with the assumption that it is designed, well, yeah, then anything that you'd like will follow, but that's exactly the issue at hand. The question is, are there natural phenomena that can explain the appearance of design in living organisms? Now, Hume made quite clear that the analogy was very weak in his dialogues concerning nature and religion. And as I said, most philosophers today agree that he was pretty much on the mark, contrary to Pauli. But he was missing one crucial part of piece of information. I mean, he did not have, in fact, an alternative explanation. In fact, Hume, in that dialogue, which was written in 1776, or published in 1776, Hume, in that dialogue, concluded by saying, look, there may be a creator out there, I don't know, there probably, in fact, is one, it's just that you can't make a convincing argument based on the design argument, because the design argument is a very poor analogy, is a very questionable analogy. He did not have, however, an alternative. He did not have an explanation for how living beings actually came to be and are diversified. That explanation, or part of that explanation at least, was provided by Darwin in 1859. That's why today's so-called intelligent design argument is even weaker than it was at the time of Paley, because now not only it is based on the same logic, which is essentially an argument from ignorance, and I'm not talking here about the personal ignorance of you know, myself or Ovin. I'm talking about the fact that a design argument essentially says, look, since I don't know how this thing came about, it must have been created by a supernatural being. That's the essence, that's the logic, the basic logic of the design argument, which you can see merely where the flaw is by simply imagining, if we were having this discussion 2,400 years ago, you know, probably Mr. Homind or somebody else would have made the argument that lightning obviously is the result of the activity of the gods, and, you know, it's Zeus that is the god of death, because we have absolutely no way to explain lightning as a natural phenomenon. And indeed, 2,400 years ago, we didn't. But that example shows that it is an argument from ignorance. It simply means if we don't know, assuming that we don't know how to explain X, the only thing that that means is that we don't know how to explain X. It doesn't mean, it doesn't imply anything else about the alternative explanations. It just seems, it just means we don't know. Now, in this particular case, on the other hand, it is true that, that we know quite a bit more now, both about lightning and about the diversification of living organisms, which means that the intelligent design argument is even weaker today than it was only 50 years ago.
Well, I disagree 100%. You're saying that the Christians are saying, since we don't know, it must have been design.
No, Christians in general. Don't call up all the Christians, because there's plenty of Christians who actually accept evolution and have no problem with it.
I can fix that.
good luck.
What you're saying, though, is, since we don't know how life got started, and since we don't know how the universe came into being, it must have evolved. You're doing the exact same thing.
No, I don't say that.
You're doing the exact same thing and saying, well, we don't know, so it must have evolved.
No, I'm sorry, Ken. I don't say that. All I'm saying is, the question of the origin of life is essentially independent from the question of the evolution of life. Now, you're right when you said a few minutes ago that, well, but in order to evolve, life had to start somehow. Sure. And of course it had to. Since I don't know how, neither I nor anybody else at this point at least know how life evolved, however, then I'm more than happy to say, well, look, since that is outside of the purview of evolutionary theory anyway, I am not bothered. That's just one more scientific question to which we don't have an answer right now. We may or may not have an answer in the foreseeable future. If I had to bet, but that would definitely be just a bet, if I had to bet, I would say that we probably will find an answer, and it will be an answer based on natural processes. But I'm not sure of that. I'm not positive. It could be, in fact, that life was put there by somebody, by some designer, which, by the way, doesn't have to be supernatural designer. As even some intelligent design advocates like William Dembski have admitted, the modern intelligent design argument points towards, argues for some kind of designer, but not necessarily for a supernatural designer. Dembski admitted, for example, although in a recalcitrant fashion, that the designer could have been a very intelligent extraterrestrial race that just seeded the earth and put the seeds of life on earth. Well, it could be. I don't know. We don't know right now. I think the most honest thing to say is simply that we don't know and not infer anything else one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Then why do we all pay to have your religion taught in the school?
As I said, the origin of life is an independent question from the evolution of life.
We also don't know that a dog has ever come from a non-dog. You might want to believe that if you want, but nobody's ever seen
it. Actually, we have pretty good information. Just because we haven't
information?
Seen it. Sorry, but Ken, the not having seen it doesn't cut it. There are plenty of things that we don't see as a
sentence. That's a flawed argument.
I'm sorry?
That's a flawed argument. We don't need to go there. I would like to know, what is the best evidence
you have? In what sense is a flawed argument?
What's the best evidence that you have of any animal ever producing a different kind of animal?
At this point, the best evidence that all animals are related to each other and therefore they were produced by common ancestors is the similarity and dissimilarity in their DNA.
I already answered that. That's evidence of a common
designer. You just said that was designed, and I told you that you can answer that to anything. There's no evidence I can bring that you can't say, oh, but God did it that way.
I was going to say, my interjecture, that's exactly what it sounds like. It sounds like once again, it seems like a reason versus faith kind of deal here. Once again, in Massimo Pigliucci, you said that evolution explains it, and it sounds like Mr. Ken Hovind, it sounds like you just said, God did it. That's what it is, pretty much what it's, and it's simplistic, but that's exactly what it sounds like.
Well, he has offered no evidence that any animal has ever produced a different kind of animal. He believes that a dog and a banana are related, but we don't see any evidence for that.
I just told you what the evidence is. You just
don't
consider that evidence. But I really like, since this is a counterpoint, which I think it's a good format, because we really get to the bottom of this thing.
Sure.
I'd like you to explain to me exactly why is it that indirect evidence about historical events, in your opinion, doesn't count. If nobody was there, you can't say anything about it. I obviously disagree with that point.
Okay, well, indirect evidence makes something a different. There's historical evidence that Abe Lincoln was president of the United States.
Right.
There is no observable evidence today. He's long gone.
Right.
But I believe Abe Lincoln was president because we have an enormous amount of historical documents and written records, and it can be demonstrated. The further back you go from human observation in the present, the more difficult some of these things become.
Mm-hmm.
And But see, we have no written historical record of how any animal produced a different kind of animal.
But we do. It's in their DNA.
The DNA.
It's interesting to think that historical record is only something that can be written by human beings, but it's not. I mean, there's archaeologists, for example, work on historical records that are artifacts, which are also made by human beings, but they're not written down. They also work on, for example, bones of animals, which are not made by human beings. But they can tell you, archaeologists can tell you, for example, what kind of animals or plants were living in a certain place tens of thousands of years ago.
No, no, there's where you're wrong. They can tell you, they can tell you what animals were living in a certain place, but they don't know the age of these things. They assume a lot of things to find the age.
Forget the age for a moment.
Okay.
They do agree that they can tell you what kind of animals was living in a certain place long ago when nobody was observing it.
Well, we don't know nobody was observing it either. But
yeah, but we don't have any historical record of somebody observing it.
I agree.
Right.
Now you're dealing with archaeology.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So if you agree with that, then what is the difference between that and accepting historical evidence in general?
Oh, I'm not in favor of throwing out historical evidence. I think certainly historical evidence can be used. But I'm telling you, you don't have any historical evidence for evolution.
Well, there's actually loads of it. There are fossils all over the place.
One at a time. No fossil could possibly count as evidence for evolution.
Of course not, because it doesn't look good to you. But
listen. You can't prove those bones had any kids, and you sure can't prove they had different kids, and you sure can't give a modern analogy of how any animal produces a different kind of animal. So if you want to place your interpretation on those bones that were found, that's fine, but that's just outside of science.
Right. Okay, let me give you an analogy here. You said those bones can't produce any kids. No, of course not, but nobody's saying that they do.
You're assuming
that
they did.
One of the problems with your approach to things is you're trying to make scientists look like fools, and most of them are not, quite frankly.
Oh,
it's kind of insulting to be treated that way, but let's go with it for a second. What you're saying is, yes, the bones don't produce kids, so you don't know who was ancestor to whom. That's a rather simplistic. Let's like saying that, for example, we can't solve a murder case. Because, you know, all we have is the powder that was left by the gun, and the powder, as you all know, doesn't kill anybody. Well, that doesn't mean anything. What the powder is a clue to what happened. And
okay.
So is the bone. Nobody's claiming that the bone gave origin to certain things or to certain organisms.
Yeah, but this is a very different level of evidence.
Uh-huh.
I'm just telling, no bone, you can't prove anything in the dirt, produced any children. And yet you're assuming that that's part of evidence for evolution. I'm telling you, in a court of law, they would laugh at you and say, I'm sorry, this is discarded. What other evidence do you have?
On the contrary, a court of law is exactly the sort of situation in which evolution will win hands down. In fact, it has won hands down over and over in a court of law, you know, historically and even more very recently in the United States. What other kind of evidence? You throw out DNA, for example, because DNA doesn't count for you.
No, I told you there's another very alternative, or very reasonable alternative.
No, that alternative, can you give me one piece of evidence, one piece of possible evidence that you couldn't possibly explain with God did it?
Okay, DNA is not just a collection of molecules.
No, answer this question, and then let's not get into a lecture on molecular biology. What kind of evidence could I possibly bring to you that would let you say, well, yeah, if that's true, I'm sorry, I'm wrong.
Oh, I would like to see, not hear about, I would like to see the proof that any animal has produced a fundamentally different kind of animal.
What would count for you as a proof?
Oh, let's have, if you believe plants and animals ultimately had a common ancestor somewhere long ago and far away, which is obviously what you believe, let's see any kind of creature today change from a plant to an animal.
That is disingenuous at the least. I told you before, these are things that by their own nature, and not because we want them that way, take millions of years. So I can't, that would be
there
the same thing as asking a geologist to produce a mountain in a minute.
There you are calling on your God time again.
No.
You said it took millions of years. You are too. You believe God, your God is time.
Look, Ken, evolution is partly an historical science. Therefore, you have to deal with historical evidence. What you're asking is the same as asking a geologist to produce a mountain in 5 minutes or to move continents all over the planet in a few days. That's simply not going to happen, and that is not a serious challenge to that science.
Evolution.
What I want to hear is, what sort of historical evidence would you take as sufficient to indicate that evolution probably occurred? I would probably. Like to, not even certainly, but probably. Hmm.
I would like to see what you have.
No, I'm asking you. I told you what I have. You said, well, I can explain that. Fine. So what kind of evidence would you want to have in order to concede that evolution is a serious possibility?
Okay, I will give you an example that may explain it then.
Okay.
If you're walking on the beach and you find somebody wrote in the sand, John loves Mary.
Yeah.
You automatically see not only just an arrangement of sand molecules, you see information, intelligent information,
mm-hmm.
assuming there's intelligence behind John loving Mary. That may
right.
not be either.
That, which is okay. questionable, depending on who
yeah.
John is and Mary is. But anyway.
Right. So there is not just an arrangement of molecules here. There is information being carried. And the DNA is not just an arrangement of chemicals. It is a message. Just like a book is not just ink on paper. It
you're
is
not, you're not answering my question.
Okay. So if you could show me where wave action produces John loves Mary, where just random, anything random in nature can produce some real empirical information, something that is other than just an arrangement of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
You, you're
the theory,
not showing me that.
The theory of evolution doesn't claim that we can explain by natural selection how John loves Mary written on the sand. The evolution claims something completely different. So I'm asking you exactly what kind of scientific evidence that is pertinent to this debate. Forget John loves Mary.
Okay.
What
yes,
sort
me.
Of evidence would you accept?
Okay. I want to see some evidence that information can arise out of chaos.
Well, that has been done, but I'm sure you don't accept that.
What has been done?
Well, we can synthesize molecules, small molecules of DNA or other nucleic acids by natural processes under laboratory conditions. Not only that, but we can actually evolve under our own very eyes. This can really literally be done in a few weeks. We can evolve those molecules. We can put molecules of this sort, for example, of RNA, which is one of the kinds of one of the two fundamental kinds of nucleic acids, in a solution with whatever other chemicals RNA needs to replicate. And not only that RNA can replicate, but in fact that RNA changes over time, and it changes in a very specific way. It doesn't change it just at random. It changes in order to increase the efficiency of its own replication. That, to me, that experiment was done by Dr. Spiegelman now back 20-plus years ago. That, to me, it's a pretty damn good piece of evidence that, yes, we can have information evolving under changing by natural processes under our very own nerve. Now, would that count as good evidence, Ken?
Well, then you're totally blind. You said it was Dr. So-and-so that did it. Here you have an intelligent person putting chemicals together to make something happen.
But the intelligent person is not telling anything to the chemicals. It's not directing the thing. It's just putting them there.
Okay, you had intelligence involved.
Well, what does that mean?
That means it requires intelligence for these things to happen.
Look, Ken, it requires intelligence to build a telescope. That doesn't mean that we make galaxies.
The galaxies
are not natural processes.
Intelligence to build a telescope and
right.
also to understand what you're looking at through the telescope.
Absolutely. That doesn't mean that the object that you're looking at is the result of intelligence, which is what you're claiming.
I think that's the obvious conclusion, just like John loves Mary. The
galaxies are the result of intelligence because we made telescopes?
Say that one more time. I didn't catch that.
Are you saying that it is logical to conclude that galaxies are the result of intelligence because we have telescopes to observe them?
No, whether we observe
okay.
them or not, I think galaxies are obvious in proof of intelligence. There's a lot of paintings that I have never seen in the world, but they all show there was a painter.
Okay.
Just to anybody of rational mind, you guys talk about being rational. Evolution is totally irrational.
You still have not answered my question.
I told you I'd like to see an animal produce a different kind of animal.
Well, I told you that is like asking a geologist to move continents on the spot.
Okay, so you're telling me you can't give me any info? You can't?
No, I'm telling you that you're being either disingenuous or simply silly about this thing. Because this
I'm very genuine. You believe this happened, but you have no evidence for it. So you're welcome to believe that, but keep your religion
at home. Let me give you another example.
Let me stop right there. I think this is perfect opportunity to go ahead and move into the next topic, and I think the third one has already pretty much been covered, unless you guys want to tackle what is science again, but that was pretty much covered in the first segment.
Okay.
But is creationism a scientific alternative to evolution? And I'd like Mr. Ken Hovind to pick that up.
Well, first, I would object to the term creationism. It should be evolutionism. Ism as in communism, Marxism, socialism, Nazism. The evolutionists have been very good in the last, 50 years of getting away with calling it creationism versus evolution as if evolution is somehow a science. and it's not. So I think if you found a painting on the tree and we were arguing, was it designed or not? And Mr. Pigliucci was taking the position it was not designed because we see no evidence of anybody around here. There are no footprints, there are no paths leading here, blah, blah, blah. And this is, after all, this painting is made of nothing but natural components. We can analyze the wood, we can analyze the, you know, the fabric, we can analyze the paint, and it's all natural components. He's welcome to, and that's what, basically what he's arguing is, that these complex things are arranged themselves by chance.
But that wasn't the question. The question was, is creationism a science?
Okay.
Or creation, whatever you want to call it, creation science.
Yeah, I think creation... The evidence for a creator is the only logical scientific conclusion. What we have here is basically two computers arguing with each other, does man exist? And the two computers are looking at each other saying, hey, we're nothing but natural components. But one says, no, but we're too complex. Yes, we're nothing but natural components, but look, we're put together in an order. There's a design here. And so the other computer says, no, nobody made us because, you know, we're nothing but natural material.
Natural material. Robots, natural material. Okay, I'm sorry.
Computers cannot see the person who designed them, nor can they probably comprehend them. But there was a designer nonetheless. And I think that the creation is the only logical scientific explanation. The creation, there must have been a creator.
So it is a science. Dr. Pigliucci?
Well, it seems to me that the word... scientific here is being used in a very light fashion. First of all, science by definition, and this is by agreement of not only scientists who are the ones that practice it, but of philosophers of science who are the ones that actually have the purpose of exploring what science is and how it's done. All these people agree on one thing. In science, there is no place for supernatural explanations. If you call in supernatural explanations, you're not doing science by definition. That, by the way, does not mean that there is no such a thing as a supernatural being. It only means that science as a goal, as an activity, has the goal of explaining as much as possible of the world by using natural processes and natural phenomena, as much as possible. It doesn't mean that it will be able to explain everything. In fact, it probably won't. And it certainly doesn't mean that there is no such a thing as a supernatural being. Opinions on the existence or non-existence of a supernatural being are philosophical opinions, not scientific ones. But all scientists and all philosophers of science agree that if you bring in a supernatural explanation, you're not doing science. Why? And it is important to understand. In fact, we're running into the third question again anyway, which is a very important question. Why is something considered science and something is not considered science? Why is it that that supernatural explanations are not allowed in science? What is it that scientists have against God? Scientists don't have anything against God. Some of them do, at a personal level, but most of them don't, by the way. We have to remind ourselves that most scientists are believers of one sort or another. So this is not a matter of God, you know, atheists versus versus Christians, which is the way many creationists want to depict it. This is absolutely false because not only many scientists are in fact Christians or belong to other faiths, but in fact many Christians, the majority of Christians, do have no problem whatsoever with the theory of evolution. So this is not a matter of Christians versus atheists. This is a matter of creationists versus evolutionary biologists. And by the way, here's an ism or ism that comes in. I don't necessarily see that the ism at the end of a word has a negative connotation.
Deism.
They have it in the sense of communism, but capitalism ends with an ism. And find me that many Americans that consider capitalism a negative thing. So ism doesn't have anything to do with being negative.
Right. There's also theism as well, Dr. Pigliucci.
There's what?
There's also theism.
Yes, absolutely, theism. And
okay.
Atheism.
So to make it a level playing field, let's call it evolutionism tonight.
Whatever. You can call it whatever you like. I don't really care.
Won't change.
The point is, why is it, the really good question is, why is it that scientists and science does not allow supernatural explanation? This is not because scientists have anything as a group of people against the supernatural realm or supernatural belief. It's because it's useless within the scientific context. Because as I showed several times tonight, there is absolutely nothing I could tell Ken Holland tonight, no kind of evidence that I could bring in that couldn't possibly be explained, and I like to put explaining scare quote here, by the occurrence of a supernatural being. I mean, literally anything, since supernatural beings, by definition, can do whatever they want, there is no limit to what a supernatural, especially an omnipowerful being, can do, then any piece of information, one way or the other, can always be explained by saying, well, God did it. God did it that way. Well, why did God did it that way? Well, because he wanted to.
But you're doing the same thing with time.
No. I'm not doing the same thing
you
with time.
You certainly are.
No, we're not just calling time here, Andy. We're not just saying, well, give me enough time, things happen. If that were what the theory of evolution were about, I wouldn't be an evolutionary biologist. Nobody would. Because it would be a silly theory. That would be, in fact, no theory at all. We're saying, given enough time and a lot of other things, and we specify which things these are. We specify the process of nature selection. We know how it works because it can be observed. The process of mutation. We know how that works because that also can be observed. And so on for several other evolutionary forces. Given time and those, we claim that evolution happens. It's not just time called in as a sort of a deus ex machina that solves everything, as you want us to believe.
Let me make a point here. Natural selection selects. It doesn't create. You're using natural selection as a creative process, and there is no evidence for this.
Natural selection, actually, there is evidence. Natural selection is what it sometimes refers to as a cumulative process.
Show me what evidence. Where has natural selection ever created some new genetic information?
Oh, there's plenty of that.
Let's see it.
Yeah. For example, we can observe under actually control. That is one thing that can be observed under control conditions. I referred before to the Spiegelman experiments with RNA, but there is also laboratory experiments that show how, for example, mutations that occur naturally under just happen in a laboratory, but not because they're induced by the experimenter. They happen naturally, spontaneously. They then are selected. Naturally, again, not by the experimenter. The experimenter there is just simply observing what is happening. These experiments are called cage experiments. These are experiments in which you put a lot of animals or plants under certain conditions so that you can observe them, and then you just let them go and see what happens. So you're not manipulating the system. You're not doing anything direct. You are not doing the selection, and you are not causing the mutations. And see what happens. Well, what happens is that things change and change in a cumulative process. For example, plants start flowering at different times, and that time shifts on a regular basis and becomes later and later and later, or earlier and earlier and earlier. The shape of flowers of certain species change and doesn't change in a random fashion, change in a way of that is functional because natural selection is occurring. And the same goes for animals. We observe natural selection in fruit flies. We observe natural selection in rats and mice and a bunch of other organisms that we can actually observe, in bacteria especially. Everything that we can observe in a very small period, in a fairly small period of time, this can be done. It's not magic. It happens.
See, when you get done experimenting with your rats or your bacteria or whatever else,
you still don't have rats or bacteria. Of course you do, because the experiment doesn't go on for millions of years.
There you go. Time is your god. Don't you see this? Don't you see how you go outside?
You're really either being disingenuous or you're being...
No, you are being disingenuous.
Purpose.
You don't see that what we observe is, yes, rats produce a variety of rats, but they're still a rat. Bacteria are still a bacteria. After all the billions that have been raised in the laboratory, they're still the same creature.
Yes, Ken, and that little hill that you have maybe outside of your house in Florida, it's still a little hill, even though in some time it may become a mountain. But it won't become a mountain over your lifetime, because it just takes time for mountains to form.
There's your god.
What god?
Oh, boy.
Time. You're not seeing it. I don't know how you can be so blind as to not see it.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Well, okay, I think we covered a lot of the topics here. I would like to go ahead and go on with the question and answer period.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
You are live with Infidel Guy. Go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to bring up a point and ask how a painting which does not reproduce itself can be a good explanation for...
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Do I?
Speak up a little bit for us, please.
Okay. I was just wanted to make a point that finding a painting in the woods as evidence for design is not really a good... explanation for evolution, because paintings don't make more paintings. And I just wanted to see if there were any comments from Mr. Hovind or Dr. Pigliucci tonight.
Well, who is it directed at?
Mr. Hovind.
Well, I think that it would be a good idea to actually make comments from both of us.
But yeah, I will, but if it's directed toward Hovind, I want Mr. Hovind respond first.
Okay, this is an excellent question. Let's suppose we find a painting in the woods that is capable of reproducing itself. Now, and that is doing it, that is reproducing itself. Now you've greatly compounded the problem. Not only are life forms on this planet unbelievably complex in themselves, they're able to reproduce more of their own kind, which makes them greatly multiplies by many orders of magnitude the complexity of the problem that the evolutionists have. So yes, let's assume we find a painting that is reproducing itself. Now, let's get an explanation.